You're listening to Black and Blue Sorry, Learning to Forgive by Kamal Dhillon. Kamal is an international speaker and the author of Black and Blue Sorry. This breakout session was recorded at the Apologetics Canada Conference on March 8, 2014 at Northview Community Church.
Good afternoon. Hi, you can do better. Good afternoon. Cheer me on. I too just had lunch. Well, it's such a privilege to be speaking to you guys in such a nice, lovely day. In case you didn't know, I love days like this. We live in a good place, right? I'm going to share on abuse and forgiveness. And sometimes my voice goes low, so if you can't hear me in the back, wave or shout, I'll get the message. It's such an honor to be invited to speak to you all, to share my painful journey. Well, it's not as painful anymore. But the reason I share my story is I want to show you that there is hope in one's darkest hour. And my prayer and hope is that once you hear my story, you will know that you can be empowered, you can help somebody, and you will be compelled to make a difference in either your lives or somebody else's lives. Now, before I share my story, I just want to say that my story, the abuse that I went through, is not gender-specific or just confined to one culture. Abuse isn't cultural. And although a lot of women are abused, there are also few men that are also victims. And not all abusers are men. And throughout my story, I will be referring to my abuser as he. So, but that doesn't mean all men are abusers. And also my story is so horrific that as I share them with you, it doesn't mean just because you haven't gone through what I've gone through that yours is less than. Every abuse, whether there's visible signs of trauma or not, is abuse, and it needs to be taken seriously. Now I'll talk about my faith too, and I don't need to do a disclaimer on that. For me, I am a single mom of four grown children, two boys and two girls, and I'm also a grandmother of an 8-year-old Caleb and 4-year-old Faith. And I'm also a grandmother of a 4-year-old golden retriever. Yeah, I can't forget that. And I live in Cloverdale. My background, really quickly, I have an Indo-Canadian background. My mother is a Hindu. My father was a Sikh. And I went to Catholic schools. So it's pretty messed. I moved to Vancouver in my early teens. My parents back home were really hardworking people. They were, our home was so comfortable that nothing actually prepared me for what I was about to endure in my married life. Sadly, my story is being played out right now as I speak by tens of millions of women all around the world. And on that note, I want to acknowledge every woman in this room and say, Happy International Women's Day. And to men too, because you guys play mom roles sometimes. Now, as soon as I turned 17, and by this time we were in Vancouver, marriage proposals started coming in. And some of the potential bachelors were such losers that I was actually thankful that my parents had some taste in men. So they waited to select the right one. By the time I was 18, I met my future husband, a young, handsome man from a very, very wealthy and influential family. When I saw him from a distance, he was very respectful to his elders, charming, he was witty. There was nothing about him that kind of sent red flags. We were married within the month. I was 18, he was 25. Soon after my wedding, my mother-in-law sat me down, when I say soon, that night, sat me down and gave me a set of rules to live by. Some of those rules were, whatever happens in your home stays in your home. From this day forth, You are to worship your husband as if he's your God. And you are to leave the room when the elders come in. The only thing that kind of stood out was, why is she telling me whatever happens in your home stays in your home? Well, it didn't take long. Probably within weeks, my husband was drinking and was going to go out with his friends to a bar. So I asked my supposedly charming and respectful husband to stay home because I didn't want him to drink and drive. But because of my interference, he hit me so hard across my face that I ended up hitting the wall and I fell to the floor. He considered this acceptable because he was going to teach me a lesson that no one talks to him like that, especially in front of his friends. That day, my husband broke my nose. The abuse continued throughout my four pregnancies, and in fact, my third child, my daughter, was born premature because in addition to hitting me repeatedly, he kicked me over and over, and I fell down a flight of stairs, and that took me into premature labor. My daughter was born 2 pounds and was in the incubator for several months, for which I was blamed. By this time, my husband had taken me and the children back to India from Vancouver under false pretense that we're actually going to go away for a holiday. But once I got to India, once my documents were destroyed, was when I realized that the ticket was always to India, because I had had my husband arrested for threatening to kill and assault. To avoid those charges, he took me back. Once in India, I thought that his parents were going to be on my side, help me live a normal life. But to my shock, my mother-in-law encouraged that my husband get rid of me. My children and I were held captive in India for 4.5 years. My abuse continued, and it escalated to physical, emotional, sexual, cultural, financial, and the list can go on. Almost daily, I was exposed to some kind of abuse, and I don't use the word abuse anymore because my abuse then turned into torture. Most of it started when it was dark. He would draw the curtains and lock the door and beat me up. Once I ran to the door to get some help, but he grabbed me before I could even get there. Then he started to put a piece of furniture, like a couch, in front of the door. The phone would be unplugged and put away. Being slapped across the face was very common. I would endure kicks if I didn't get up from the floor after being thrown there. Now, if his hands were too sore to hit me, then he would take out his leather belt and swing it across my entire body until he was tired. See, one of the challenges I have today is speaking and eating. Because during many of the slaps, punches, and kicks, one of the things my husband did was broke my jaw. So today, I live with an artificial jaw. In fact, in October of last year, I went back to Toronto for my 10th jaw surgery. While having this artificial implants put in, halfway through the surgery, I had a heart attack. And I had 3. And so my left side couldn't be done. And I have to go back. But I have scars. And I often say to myself, these scars don't define who I am. I am defined by who I am as a person and what I do. I will no longer let my husband have that entitlement that I destroyed her. My husband would call me all kinds of names and his family, except my own. I had labels like good for nothing, useless bitch, ugly. These were names that I was hearing all the time. I was stopped from speaking to my friends and then my family. Isolation was my companion. My husband brainwashed me by saying to me that if I ever used the phone or called somebody or reached out to somebody, that he would find out and often threatened to kill my family and then kill me. See, he bought my silence using the love for my children. Sexual abuse occurred late at night, especially after enduring hours of torture. At times it happened when the children were asleep. Other times he didn't care whether they were up or not. Most of this was extremely violent. I was frequently sodomized. Sometimes I would be left outside all night. Other times I'd be left inside, stripped and tied up. My four children were also victims. They were so terrified by seeing this violence that what they started doing was actually making a secret bed under their bed so that they could hide there in the times of abuse. Other times when they couldn't get under their bed, they would actually cover their faces with a pillow. So in their mind, if they didn't see it, it didn't happen. He never, ever failed to remind me of his rights as a husband and a breadwinner of the family. Even my culture promotes that. The boys are given preference, and we girls are regarded less than. We were taught not to raise our voice, so we were taught not to stand up for any injustice. While I can't remember how many times my husband tried to kill me, either by poisoning me, hanging me, drowning me, I knew after almost 10 years that if I didn't escape, one of us was going to die. So I decided enough is enough. One day, my husband took me to this ocean. I had been to this ocean before. So did my children. We knew that this was the final moments, late night. And so I looked back into the back seat where the four young children were sleeping, and I waved goodbye. As he dragged me out of the car, I remember just mumbling and hoping that whoever I'm talking to will hear me. I said to my four children, I named them, and I said, "My babies, I didn't want you to be here to see this. It's not my choice, but I am going to die in the next few minutes. But I want you to know that Mom, as she took her last breath, she remembered you. You were the last people on her mind. Message to my boys, please be there for your sisters. Don't let your sisters become his next victims." Then I remembered my mom and dad. And I mumbled again, and my parents were in Vancouver. And I said, "Mom, Dad, you abandoned me many years ago because of shame, because of pride. But today your little girl is being led to the slaughter. Please be there for my children." As I said that, I lost my balance on the slippery docks. He continued to kick me, hit me, and then asked me to call for help, to call my mother, and also to call my lover, who he explained was the cop that arrested him. In his twisted mind, this cop became my lover. As I began to scream at his request, he also kicked me in my face, and I lost a couple of teeth. I could only hear my echoes for a while. And after a while, he said, "No one's coming, scream louder." So I did. To my surprise, the echo became very clear enough for me to know that it was a man's voice. I changed whatever I was saying to telling him exactly where I was. And all of a sudden, I realized that I had seen there was a big, bright lights where I was standing. And I remember looking up and thinking, oh, this caretaker must have a very bright flashlight. I'm going to ask him for it. It was then that I realized that my husband wasn't there. I was there alone. I heard them talking. So I yelled back at this man and I said, excuse me, sir, I am so-and-so's daughter-in-law. My husband is going to kill me. Can you please call the cops? My husband said to him, if you call the cops, I'll kill you. I didn't hear back from this man. And I thought to myself, dear God, he's dead. This man is dead. But that for that little time, I got myself out of the water and just held on to the rails and got to the car. So my children, even though I had a lot of injuries, he had crushed my knuckle hoping I'd let go of the metal rails. Some reason I just got more strength. I got back into the car, went home, and the cops did come. But they never came to me. They left after talking to my father-in-law and my husband. Well, that injuries, that incident, gave me some power to go to my father-in-law, showed him everything that I had gone through. And for the first time, he said, I know what you're going through, and I will send you and the children back to Vancouver. Told my children to keep a secret that we're going home. They packed the little bags and kept it a secret until I got an envelope. They wanted to see what a ticket looked like. So I opened the envelope, and to my surprise, there was only one-way ticket. I ran downstairs and I said, Dad, you made a mistake, or the travel agency made a mistake. Four tickets are missing. He looked at me and he said, we're not giving you our children. These are our children. You have a choice. You can choose to leave, or you can choose to stay in the same condition. And I chose to stay because I could not bear the thought of leaving my children, especially my girls, with them. A few days later, my husband doused me with kerosene, handed me the matches. Then he hung me by my sari. Few days after that, he raped and sodomized me in front of my son. And that was it. I left the country. As I was leaving, I remember his words loud and clear saying, you are a mother that will abandon your children anytime. His words almost became true. I can still hear, if I sit down quietly, I can still hear the screams of my four little children begging me, Mom, please take us. We'll be quiet. Put us in your bags. And we're so sorry that we hurt you and we made you cry. But please take us. And I abandoned them and I left the country. A few days later, I was abandoned because they had destroyed all my documents. So I was stranded and waiting for my documents. I got to the airport and I realized, as a victim, most of us, we don't trust people. We have huge trust issues. And so I'm sitting in a corner facing the wall waiting for my flight and I see a family of four looking in my direction. And I tried, if I could have gone in through the wall, I would have, to avoid this family. The woman came over and sat beside me, and I kept moving until I looked at her and I said, what do you want? And she slowly asked me what my name was after introducing herself. And I said, what is my name today? So I thought about it, and I thought, today my name is Unfortunate. Because the very thing that I would die for, my four children, is what I lost. The most beautiful children in the world, and I have no privilege and honor being a mother to them. So she said to me, you know, Jesus loves you. And so the more she talked about Jesus, the more annoyed I was getting. Because I had too many gods in my life. And I wasn't willing to give another God a chance. They all failed me, and they all abused me. And so the more she talked, the more angry I was getting. And I finally looked at her and I said, "Are you a Jesus freak?" She smiled and she said, "I know what you've been through. But remember, every tear that you've shed, God has collected it. And He will use it. You don't know why." And so I kept arguing and saying, "Where was Jesus? Did He enjoy this? I have many broken bones. Did He take pleasure?" "Oh yeah, Jesus is a man, right?" So I said all these things, but she wasn't moved. And she told me that one day, God saved me for a purpose. And one day, I will know why He saved me. I wrote a long list at the request of this woman on the plane home. And most of them were demanding God for this and for that. And every other line was, "I want my 4 children. ASAP. I want a brand new house. I want this." So I thought, why not throw in a wish list in there too? In my journey, fast forwarding till today, I wish I had kept that list. Because not only God met those, He exceeded it. And as a single mom, as one who has lost all her nerves in the face, I am being used by God to bring healing, to bring hope to so many. This is not just a woman's issue. It's also a man's problem. And I'm here to tell you that no matter what, we can question, why would a loving God allow all this injustice? I don't understand. I don't have an answer. I don't know why there's evil. But what I do know is that we can make a difference in somebody. I eventually, when I got to Vancouver after making that list, I arrived and came out of the customs. And to my utter shock, guess who's at the airport to greet me? My husband. I thought I was coming to freedom, but yet again, I was going to be his prisoner. I had no choice but stay with him because he promised to get the children, and he did not deliver. So I ran away one morning after enduring all night abuse. He brought the older 2 children within a few months, and the only way I could see the children was to come back to him. So I did. And again, the abuse continued. I did not even have a quarter to my name to run and call for help. But I did dial 0 and beg the operator not to hang up on me because my husband was going to kill me. She did call help. The police came, took me home, got my children. My husband was arrested. And that was the last day I was with my husband. We never looked back. We went from transition house to transition house, from one city to another city, from one island to another island, because we would be he would find us. Eventually, as my faith grew, as I started trusting in people, people started, mature Christian women would say to me, "You need to forgive." And I did not understand forgiveness, so I would avoid these women. 2.5 years later, I heard God's voice, and I went, and I kidnapped my children from India and smuggled them into Canada. Now my family was complete. And today, the day that I brought my children back to Vancouver, was the day that my parents met me after all these years. And my dad said, "Today I am very proud of you." Why he was proud of me was because years earlier, my father said to me, don't leave your husband. Go back and stay with him. I will come and get you one day, but for today you go back. What he really, his words were, I will come for your body. Don't shame me now. I'd rather you die than you be a divorced woman. So I got my children together. We started a new life, still in hiding. Then I get a phone call one day, and the phone call was from my husband's niece. And she said to me, get ready, get the children ready. We need to go back to India, the next flight. And I said, what happened? Your husband is dead. My husband was found dead not far from the water where he was trying to drown me. At his funeral, I felt the Lord ask me, would you forgive him? I began to understand what forgiveness was and who it was for. And at that point, I realized that forgiveness really was for me, to free me from him. Even though he was dead, he was still, his memories, everything was still haunting me. And I chose to forgive him at his funeral. What made it maybe a bit easier was years before, he would drive me and my four children where the cemetery was and point where I would be cremated and where my ashes would be thrown. And he would ask the children, who wants to light the fire? And this poor, terrified children slowly would put their hand up and say, I'll do it first. And here I was, a woman who was not allowed in the cemetery, but I went with my children and I cremated his body. But before I did that, I chose to forgive him. It didn't free me right away from anything, but it was like a big onion. I was peeling layers, and it took several years until I was completely free, but my children weren't. Today, I can say with confidence that my children have forgiven, and they are now participating in the next book that I'm writing. Looking back, everywhere I go to speak, people ask me brutal question. Why didn't you leave any sooner? I'd rather you not ask that. We don't like the abuse. We don't want to stay there. But if we don't have support and if we live in fear, how can we leave? You know, most of us victims are most vulnerable and in the most dangerous place the moment we leave, because they are enraged, they're looking. One thing my husband actually did as a demonstration was he took a gun to my relatives where my brother and my mom were and pointed the gun at them. And I protected him from that. I told the cops he didn't have a gun. Why I said that was because I was pregnant, and one of the police officers said to me, if you're not honest, the gun's going to be turned on you tomorrow. You and your baby are going to be dead. And I thought to myself, if I tell you he has a gun, you will let him go in 4 hours, and he's going to come back and get it. You just told me you can't babysit me. So I protected him. Why didn't I leave any sooner? Simple answer is, he brainwashed us into believing that he will kill us, that the children will be taken away from me, that I could be charged, that I would be penniless. Even when we had the opportunity, I couldn't leave. He actually had told my parents, he had them against me, and I believed, and my parents actually believed everything he said because he was such a charming guy. In our culture, my community, if I left him, I would be shunned. Because for we women that are divorced or separated, we're looked at as totally loose women. We're disgraced. And so I wasn't raised in a community or in a family to be independent or self-sufficient. So I knew that if I left, I would never be completely free. But as I grew spiritually, I made new friends. I had family. The church became my family. Friends like Judy, my publicist, they became my source of strength. Now, as I forgave my husband, I knew that the journey would be very difficult. And so one of the things that I want to share that my daughter speaks out when she's talking of her time with the father was, even though it's nice and sunny outside, our home was always dark. She would say, we couldn't wait to get home after school to see if mom was there, still alive. She said, we never saw mom crying during all these years that dad was there, until after dad was out of the picture and we became a family again and began to pray together. It was then that we saw mom crying, this time to God. Today, my girls have joined me in becoming loud voices against bullying and abuse. Now, with regards to my boys who were taught to hit me, to abuse me, they too are now cheering me on. Healing will and is always part of our lives. But I can say with hope that we will always give God the priority. And healing will always be part of our lives. And prayers is what keeps us going strong. Because none of us are without pain. We've all suffered. So I ask that you do not give up on yourselves, because the world has given up on us. And don't let your circumstances dictate your future. There may not be any easy answers, but I know that in the midst of it, God has all the answers. Some of the steps really quickly, and I will take your questions or comments if you have any. Some of the steps that I took to become a better person was allowing people into my life. Facing my demons. Receiving counseling from myself and my children, and learning to trust another person again. Learning to love myself and forgiving myself. Accepting that hate, anger, and bitterness was only destroying me. And then understanding that if I wanted to be a role model, an example to my children, then I had to live that life as well. As I joke about myself, I often wonder, why would God use a person like me? Because sometimes when I read the Bible and I come to this certain place where God uses foolish ones, and I'm thinking, I'm the worst. Why would you use me? And I'm humbled that God has opened so many doors where I have had opportunities to speak at the World Bank in Washington, D.C., as a joint venture with International Monetary Funds. Just all over Canada and certain places in America, even the senators have invited me in from Obama administration to come and educate the educators. Who better to educate than a person who's already been there and knows firsthand? I also do regular talks at Justice Institute with the probation officers, the police officers, and any professionals. I go to schools. I don't let those things get to me, because at the end of the day, my goal is to save a life so that parents can go to bed knowing that their little girl is safe tonight. I share this because you may have a neighbor. You may know somebody. And to think that domestic violence is a private matter is very wrong. It's a crime. Today it's happening to others. Tomorrow it could happen to you. And I'm asking you not to keep this matter so confidential that no one knows about it. Speak out. Join with me and be a voice for those that don't have one. Let's be silent no more. That's how I'm going to end. And let's start to help each other. Be the hands and feet of Christ. Thank you. Thank you.
If you guys have any questions, now it's time to do so.
Are you all okay?
Yes.
Yeah.
You were saying that in your culture, that the divorce is sort of seen as, you know, that you're a loose woman. Now, at this time, do you feel like you're still an outsider of your culture, or is there an opening, like, you know, there are more women talking about this?
No, there isn't a lot of women still talking about it. They'd rather I talk about it and get all the blame and shame and whatever. But I'm not stopping, because I know the emails that I get, the, you know, secret notes, is that they're saying, thank you. Thank you for being that voice, because now my dad can understand what I'm going through. But if they think, if they speak out, then they're admitting something, which they don't want to admit. They still want to live with that sense of pride. Yeah. Yeah.
When you suspect by seeing a woman in your circle, perhaps someone is a close friend, but you suspect that there's beating or something going on, do you have any suggestions of how to make that first conversation happen?
Just let them know you can be trusted, because a lot of people have been betrayed. When somebody says to you, you know, I'm going to share something, please don't share it with anybody. Make sure you give her your word, because if you start to talk about that person to somebody else, you're no different than their abuser. A lot of times we may not even speak it out, but our silence is speaking loud and clear. You know, I may not look you in the eye as I used to. Pick up little signs. Is they're always looking at the time. They're always making excuses, canceling things the last minute. Maybe their blinds are not opening in your neighborhood. There's a lot of stuff. He's doing all the talking, and we label her as a snob. I know a lot of people said that to me. Well, you never talked. I wanted to. I was hoping that you would pick up. You know, when I gave you that look, like, I'm in pain, I need help, I was still talking. The reason I wasn't verbally saying it was, if my husband had warned me before we leave the house, you dare speak, you know what's going to happen. So gain trust, confidence, and be there. When you say, call me anytime, make sure you answer their calls when they call anytime.
I guess it's even before that, like, I don't know for sure that there's abuse, but I'm seeing bruising, I'm seeing...
It's okay to ask. It's okay.
Is it?
It is.
Like in a private setting where no one...
Yeah, exactly.
But what do you say?
Ask her if she's okay. Ask her if she's okay. And let her know you're there for her. There may be 10 times you'll have to ask. You know? Because they will not admit the first time or the second time. But don't give up. That's what I'm saying. Don't give up. Let them know that you care. Because they've never trusted anyone. Okay? But do ask, do offer to be there for them. Think of the alternative if you don't ask. Yeah.
Anywhere at the airport, you said you had this lady come up to you talking about Jesus. I guess this was your first encounter where somebody talked to you about Jesus?
I went to a Catholic school most of my life, but it was, the timing was just so right. Even though I was so angry, had she not come? Because when she came, it was, oh, you care enough? And I was so lonely that I needed somebody to hear me.
And how did you find your way into a church then in Canada?
When I came back and my husband got me, and then I ran away. I ended up in a shelter, and the last shelter was actually a Salvation Army. And then I found the workers to be all kind of happy, and they all seemed to be praying. And after they prayed, they were even more happier. So I thought there must be something good about this God.
How do you actually end abuse? Like, I'm sorry. I should have raised my hand. Like, you know somebody is getting abused, and you contact them, and the husband finds out, and, you know, even if you call the police, he may be questioned for a while. He goes back home and beats up his wife, and the cycle continues. How do you end that cycle?
Statistics will show you there may be police coming to your house at least 30 times. But I suggest call anytime you suspect, because we want to send that message out to the abuser that this will not be tolerated, especially in this country. Second of all, we're also telling her that you have protection. Oftentimes when he's arrested and there's visible evidence that there was abuse, he was not allowed back in the house. But if she chooses to bring him back, at least, you know, never give up on her again. Keep doing what you're doing, because there'll come a day when she'll say, enough is enough, I'm done. But, you know, we go through this guilt. I was speaking on Wednesday, and there was a provincial court judge, and she said this woman came to the police station battered, bleeding, sweating, because she was running and she didn't even have shoes on. And she started giving her statement to the police officers. Halfway through, she said, I'm sorry. You know what? He's not that bad. He just kind of had a bit too much to drink. So please just forget it. Forget what I said. The guilt takes over. And then we start to make excuses in our own mind. But there comes a time when they say this is enough. And that's when we have to still be there for them and with them and say, never give up on you. You had a question.
Just curious how your husband died and what support, if any, did the family, his family, provide to you or anything?
He died under very mysterious circumstances. One of the things that I know for sure is a week before that, I had actually done an interview with, it was BCTV then, Global News Now, on deadbeat dads, dads that don't pay child support. And I was a little bit tricked in that interview, in the sense that the reporter told me and made me a promise that they will not contact my husband. But they did. And he found out that I was doing this interview, and they waited to air that interview until they got his story. After that story was aired, he was missing. And a week later, his body was found. From what I found out was because he had to give me my share of the company, they got rid of him. When he was found, I didn't even recognize his body. I thought they tricked me. He had a broken jaw. He had both eyes missing. He had the same kind of injuries that I have in one knuckle. He had it in all. And it was probably about a half mile away from where I was going to be drowned that his body was found. I don't know details, and I choose not to know, because I probably will never get the truth, but he was murdered. Second question was the support for me. There was no support. Actually, I was blamed for his death. Instead of them taking the responsibility, they said that she drove him to the point where he committed suicide. So then I and my children had to go in hiding. We're still being threatened quite a bit, but the way I look at it is, no man can take me out of the race, only God can, and I go with his protection and covering. Yes?
I was wondering, how many years did it take you to really find peace?
I was in the marriage for almost 12 and a half years. And it took another several years for me to come to a place of letting go the hate that I had. and coming to a place of forgiveness. I think when my book came out about 4 years ago was when I was totally free. So it took a very long time, I would say at least 18 years, to come to this place where, and again, you know, as much as I talk about forgiveness, how do you then stay in forgiveness? And one of the things in my last surgery was I was so hopeful after a 12-hour surgery, I'm going to come home with a brand new jaw, everything's going to be fine, and I'm going to return to my normal life, only to find out the next day when I woke up was that I had a heart attack. My jaw surgery was incomplete. And so anger, you know, because for at least 6 weeks you can't eat. And I leave, you know, children here. I have no income. And then all this anger. But how do you stay in forgiveness? And so that's a really key thing, is staying in that place where you're not going to allow your abuser to now rob the peace that you worked so hard for. Just going back to God's word and saying, I choose to let it go. Okay.
Okay. I think we ran out of time. If you could thank her for the time.